Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you, as always, for being here. You can hear from the sound of my voice that I am a bit better than I was this time last week, although not still 100%. Whatever this thing that I had all over the Christmas, which wasn't COVID because I kept testing for COVID, it kept coming up negative. But like headaches and tiredness and a cough, I've still got a cough. And then these sort of weird periods of low-level nausea, which lasts for a couple of hours and then they go away and then they come back again. And at this point, I would just like it to fuck off and then continue fucking off and then fuck off some more and not come back, because I'm pretty tired of not feeling well. Nevertheless, football is back, and football, and Arsenal in particular, have lifted the spirits with a 3-1 win over West Ham on, I was going to say Boxing Day, but we don't call it Boxing Day in Ireland, just December 26th, or if you're religious, St. Stephen's Day. But we won that game and extended our lead briefly at the top of the table to 8 points. It's back down to 5 points now because Manchester City, they beat Leeds, as I pretty much expected that they would. No word of a lie, I had a dream the other night where Erling Haaland was some kind of like a vampire or a monster or something, and he was chasing me up this corridor, and I kept shooting him. I kept shooting him in the chest, and there was blood and stuff everywhere, but it didn't matter how many times I shot him, he just kept coming. And I'd like a sort of big shotgun type thing. I was like, and he'd just keep coming after me and after me. And, I'm no dream expert or anything like that, but I guess that one's not too hard to work out. On one level, I guess it's that Manchester City are chasing us, and they're going to keep chasing us and keep chasing us. But on the other, it seems fairly clear to me that Manchester City have ploughed all their money into creating the world's first Terminator football player, the E2000. Maybe in time the truth will come out, but, I trust my subconscious on this one. So about today's episode, we're going to chat to Lewis Ambrose. It's a bit of a weird one because of the time of year, because of the days, and nobody knows quite what day it is, and there's things going on with New Year's Eve and all sorts. So this is sort of like an Arscast crossed with our usual Patreon preview podcast, which we do for our Patreon members. But this week, we're going to sort of combine the two into one and just put it out on the main feed. Things will get back to normal next week. Don't worry, Patreon members. But Mikel Arteta's press conference is not until 4 o'clock tomorrow on Friday, and I have a thing to go to, so I won't be able to get the preview podcast done on the Friday, and then on Saturday, well, you know, by the time you get up and do everything and the match is on then that day. So look, this is regular Arscast / preview podcast, and as I said, when the schedule and life and everything else gets back to normal, podcast schedules will get back to normal as well. So look, let's get on with it, and let's see what Lewis has to say for himself. Hello, Lewis.
Hello, Andrew. I hope you're well.
I'm doing better than I was this time last week, so, you know, I'm looking at things on the up and up. And of course, Arsenal have won, and, you know, that helps as well. You know, football team winning is the best medicine, as the old saying goes. You know how it is.
Yep. I've got something to say on that later.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now I'm in suspense. Don't forget it now, because I don't know what I need to say to bring it up, just in case, you know?
Yeah, I'll remember.
Okay,
don't worry.
You remember. So, how have you viewed the week's Premier League action? Arsenal, of course, beat West Ham to go, well, 7 points clear of plucky underdogs, poor little Newcastle United. But 8 points ahead of Manchester City for a brief period until they won, until they beat Leeds and cut the defeat to, cut the lead to 5 points. Erling Haaland saying, "We have to hunt Arsenal," which is quite ominous from a guy like that. But how do you?
We're clearly in his head.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, we've got him rattled. Do you think?
Yeah. I mean, he's going to bed thinking, what can I do to catch Arsenal?
It's yeah. Great. How many more goals do I got to fucking score here? but a decent week, obviously, you know, for Arsenal. I mean, when you look down the table, I think it's a 10-point gap to Tottenham with a game in hand, is it? Or is the game in hand on the other two? I don't know.
I think it was briefly two games in hand after they played before we did on Boxing Day.
Yeah, your reflections very quickly on the West Ham game, the first game without Gabriel Jesus, and what you thought of how we played without Gabriel Jesus. Did you notice any significant difference in the way that Mikel Arteta set up his team or looked for his team to operate, you know, without a guy who's been so pivotal to the way that we play?
Not particularly myself, I don't think. I wondered a little bit. I think it's just a matter of who we had available at left back to start. And I did wonder a little bit during the first half, especially with Kieran Tierney, who just doesn't come inside into midfield as often and as much and as drastically, I guess, as Alexander Zinchenko does. Does him then going outside on the left, like get Gabriel Martinelli closer to the middle of the pitch and maybe closer to the goal at times? But I don't think there was a huge difference. I think we've talked about it and we saw it at the back end of last season that Eddie Nketiah has learned really over the last 18 months or so to play that role where he tucks into midfield and he offers to, you know, receive the ball with his back to goal and maybe lay it off or try and turn, spin and then get back in the box. I wasn't too surprised really with any of that. I think we'll be a little bit less flexible, and I think you saw that. Gabriel Jesus just sort of floats everywhere. And I think Eddie will drop into midfield. I don't see him maybe switching positions with Gabriel Martinelli out wide as much or Bukayo Saka on the other wing. But no, there wasn't much else really for me. And I think, you know, West Ham are a decent side. They're a side that defends well, especially. And for us to control and dominate the game, I think, from start to finish as well as we did, I don't think you can have too many complaints or reservations based on that 90 minutes about us playing the amount of football we're going to have to play without Gabriel Jesus.
The sort of right side of our attack, which involves Bukayo Saka, who was sensational the other night. You know, on reflection, I think his performance, having watched it again, I think his performance was even better than I thought it was. And I thought it was pretty good at the time. Same with Martin Odegaard. I mean, that's a really important part of how this team works, isn't it? That Odegaard, Saka, Ben White is involved in that little triangle as well. The way that he gets forward and overlaps to provide that outlet, either for a ball or for Saka to come back inside. But there's sort of more decisiveness, I think, about the way that these guys are operating now. You know, this is the first game back after the World Cup, so you could expect things to be a little bit slow for one or two of them. Saka had a very good World Cup, scored 3 goals for England, has come back, scored straight away for us. You know, and Odegaard, I think he'd 6 shots the other night. One of them, turned into an assist. And one of the criticisms that I think people have had of him, and there was a moment actually early in the game where perhaps he could have had a shot, and he went for a little pass through to Martinelli. But 6 shots from Martin Odegaard, I mean, this is a development in his game that I'm sure has come through conversations and talks with Mikel Arteta, but he just looks like a more confident player in the final third than he did even maybe this time last year when, you know, his quality was apparent even then.
He's our top goal scorer still, right, this season in the league. I think he's that nose for goal, that eye for goal is clearly there at the moment. Yeah, he almost gave me the impression towards the end of the West Ham game of a player a little bit frustrated that he hadn't got his goal. Some of the efforts, he was sort of cutting in onto that left foot and trying to find the far post and not finding it, or the far corner. Yeah, he's brilliant. I thought he was by far the standout player in the West Ham game. I thought he was brilliant. There was obviously the sort of scuffed, pulled shot, if you like, that led to Saka's goal, and there was the assist for Nketiah, but I thought there were a few other passes that just so nearly came off. There was one that he really disguised and slid it through the defence for Granit Xhaka, and it was just too much weight on it, and Xhaka didn't have the legs to get there in the first half. I thought Odegaard was spectacular in the entire game. I thought he controlled pretty much the whole match. And certainly when we were on the ball and moving forward, he was conducting everything. So, yeah, I think, you know, we keep reminding ourselves, and then you don't want to think, you know, we've got to demand more from these players, but we do keep talking about Martinelli and Saka and Odegaard, and you've got to remember how young they are, and we're like, but there is more to come from them, or there should be more to come, hopefully, from each of them. Odegaard and Saka, yeah, on that right-hand side. And like you say, Ben White as well. Ben White was involved in the third goal. He had a few really nice moments overlapping and getting outside in the first half, leaving, I think, Ben Rama on the ground at one point before he chipped the ball into the box. All of them. You know, I thought what was really nice about the West Ham game was it was one of those matches, and obviously there was the penalty and the time that we were a goal down. I wasn't ever too worried watching it that we weren't going to find our way through. But it was just one of those games where you come back out of it and think every single one of them played well today. And it's, even when you're top of the league and winning most games, I still think there are places to nitpick or performances to pick out. And I genuinely thought all 11 players were good and solid against West Ham. And that's just really, really nice. It's something that I'm still getting used to as an Arsenal fan, being able to end a game and have that thought.
Yeah. I don't want to nitpick now after what you said, and I'm not nitpicking in any way. I think what's interesting about some of the stories that we've heard about this week when it comes to January, when it comes to transfer window and players we might be interested in, is, you know, the depth on the bench, bit of attacking depth and what have you, because we don't have Smith Rowe. We didn't have Tomiyasu the other day as well. Reece Nelson, of course, is out injured. Gabriel Jesus, who we've already mentioned. And when you look at the bench, you know, in the second half, let's say you really need a goal. Let's say you're behind or you're chasing a game and you're looking and thinking, well, okay, Zinchenko, he's a good substitute to have. And Fabio Vieira, we know that he can score a goal. But beyond that, there wasn't a great deal on the bench for Mikel Arteta to turn to. And I think that's an issue that might be more acute when it comes to some of the bigger games against some of the bigger opposition. You know, we are facing Newcastle soon. We're facing Manchester United soon. There's a North London derby coming up soon as well. So, are you in any way surprised that this week we have the bid for Mykhailo Mudryk? Who knows how much it's going to cost to get that guy out of Shakhtar Donetsk, but they seem open to negotiating anyway. And David Ornstein sort of dropping a little bomb on NBC where he talked about how Arsenal are looking at João Felix as an option as well. Whether that's, you know, okay, a message to Shakhtar, we've got our eyes on another player, I'm not 100% sure. I don't know. It could be a case that we're just after the two players. But are you in any way surprised that these two attacking players are the guys being linked with Arsenal at the moment?
I think they make sense in that they're, I think, versatile. We've talked about that. There's no point, right, bringing in a player who can play in one position, because if they can play, say, on the left where Gabriel Martinelli's been playing, and then they're injured, then we're just in the exact same position where we've got the same 11 players or the same sort of front three. If they can play on both wings, for example, then obviously they can deputise for Martinelli or for Saka. And if they can play up front or and on one of the wings, then they can take Eddie Nketiah's place. So it obviously makes sense that we can if we can find somebody who can play in multiple positions across the front three. And then it's just January, right? Like, how many players are out there that are just unavailable, basically? The clubs are just going to say, right, yeah, middle of the season, 120 million, please. And these two players are clearly available. Mudryk for the right price. I think any player, really, but Mudryk's right price seems to be, I don't know. We'll see what Shakhtar are playing, how much they actually want. They're clearly playing hardball. They clearly think that he's a player who can bring in a lot of money. I'd be curious to see, but I think he can certainly play on both wings. And then you've got João Félix, who can play anywhere across the front three and is a player who's incredibly available thanks to not wanting to be at Atletico Madrid anymore.
What do you think? I mean, do you think it's about him not wanting to be at Atletico Madrid or Atletico Madrid not wanting him anymore? Where do you think it's kind of gone wrong there?
I think we need to separate Atletico Madrid and Diego Simeone as things. I think he doesn't really fit that well for Diego Simeone. You know, he emerged at Benfica as this flair attacking player, really, a really creative wide player. It was odd to me that Atletico Madrid decided with Diego Simeone in charge to trigger his release clause. Was it, I think, 120 million euros when they bought him? To spend that amount of money on a kind of wiry, young playmaker type forward didn't really tally with Diego Simeone as your coach.
Yeah.
So that was a strange one for me from the very off. For him, I'm sure that was an attractive move to a big team that's always in the Champions League and competing for La Liga once every couple of years. But they never seem to fit together. The Atletico Madrid president has said recently that João Félix just wants to leave and that, as far as he's concerned, they still think he's a player that's incredibly talented, hence they want to recoup all 120 million that they spent on him.
Yeah,
if they're to sell him. But it's, you know, which is why a loan would make sense, at least for us. It would make sense for him to put himself in that shop window, if you like, and for Atletico as well, maybe, if there's a player that's not happy and they need to sell him. He's not going to prove that he's worth 120 million there because he doesn't fit. And if he's going to prove that anyway, he's going to have to go and show it for someone before they recoup any sort of transfer fee for him anywhere near the amount that they're going to ask for. So, yeah, it was always a strange fit, I think. And I think we'd be a more sensible fit. As for January moves, that's the problem, right? Bringing somebody in now, it could work really, really well. Or it could take 2 or 3 months for somebody to bed in. And by that point, how much of a use have they been for you? Luckily, we're in the Europa League as well. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see any January signing play a lot of Europa League minutes while the tempo is different to a Premier League game, while they're getting used to what Mikel Arteta wants from them. And in the meantime, they'll get off the bench here or there in the Premier League and hopefully find themselves into the team when we need them. But I think that's just the problem with this month, this window that we get in the middle of the season. You're never quite sure how much you can rely on a player in the back end of the season when you need them.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, January's been hit and miss, you know, when it comes to loan deals. You go back a few years and we did the Denis Suarez deal, which I think ended up costing somewhere between £4 and 5 million in total with loan fees and wages and stuff like that. And with all due respect to Denis Suarez, I think it's fair to say we didn't really get value for money out of that one. Martin Odegaard, there's a sort of synchronicity there, isn't there, with the João Félix thing, a player, highly rated player at a Madrid club things aren't going as well as he would like, so he's open to a move. Slightly different because, you know, it's not like Real Madrid paid 100 and something million for Martin Odegaard. They brought him in when he was 15. But you'd have to think that if this is a player that Mikel Arteta and Edu want to bring in, they must feel relatively confident that he is able to to get up to speed. You know, he doesn't have fitness issues, for example. That'd be a key thing. Like, you don't want a guy who's, you know, I don't know, going to arrive with a broken back or something, you know. you don't need that, because you need the guy in the team as quickly as you can possibly get them in the team. I mean, there are other discussions. I saw journalist Kike Marin talk about how Mikel Arteta has some doubts about João Félix. Now, I don't know if it's doubts about the player or if it's doubts about the deal, you know, the size of the wages, because I think the wages are somewhere around 280,000, 250 to 280,000 a week is what he's on at Atletico Madrid, which is, you know, commensurate with the kind of transfer fee they paid for him. You know, that is probably more than any Arsenal player is on, even Gabriel Jesus. Mm-hmm. So that might be a sticky issue. You know, Arsenal could contribute to the wages, but maybe not pay 100% of the wages. So he may have some doubts about the deal itself. Also talk of Ferran Torres, who is a player that we've been linked with in the past as well. Former Man City player, went to Barcelona. This was kind of lost in the end of the last transfer window, when we were panicking and looking for a central midfielder because of the injuries to Elneny and Partey. There was a Spanish newspaper reported, it wasn't Sport or it wasn't El Mundo, it could have been one of the main dailies, reporting that Arsenal had a bid for Ferran Torres turned down in the last 2 days of the transfer window. Barcelona didn't want to let him go. So he's a player that Mikel Arteta obviously seems to like as an alternative to the João Félix arrival. You know, he's 22 years of age. He's quite creative. He looks like he can play across the front line as well.
Yeah, he has. Yeah.
You know, another possibility.
He used him up front quite a lot at the start of last season.
Mm. And a highly rated player. Another kind of, not a work in progress, but another one of these players who is coming in with maybe something to prove. And I think that's part and parcel of, not always, but I think Mikel Arteta kind of likes that a bit. You know, there's a touch of the Arsene Wenger signing Kanu or Mark Overmars after his knee injury, or even Thierry Henry to an extent. You know, it hadn't worked out for him at Juventus, and he sort of brought him in and changed the trajectory of his career. I don't think that's, you know, what Mikel Arteta is thinking first and foremost. He's not some kind of footballing Samaritan trying to rescue the careers of guys he likes. But, you know, I do think there's something to the idea that a player is coming, you know, having been at Man City, having been at Barcelona, and it hasn't really worked for him at either of those clubs, to come to somewhere like Arsenal where, you know, to me, he feels like a good fit. I'm not saying he's the perfect player, but he feels like a good fit for what we might need in the second half of the season, you know, particularly if you can do a loan deal and you don't necessarily have to commit to something. But, you know, if it works out as it did with Martin Odegaard, you can convince a guy that maybe this is the place you need to be.
Yeah, I'm sure pretty high up on their list of aims for whoever they're targeting right now is a player who can play more than one position.
Yeah.
Be that up front and on one of the flanks or on both flanks. I'm pretty confident that that's one of the things they're definitely looking for. And he ticks that box, definitely. He also probably ticks the box of being able to come in and not demand a starting place. He'll get more minutes than he's currently getting at Barcelona, but you wouldn't have to drop any of the current front three to make space for him. You know, there are some players, Mudryk could be one. I don't think he personally would demand a starting place in the 11 right now, but if you're going to spend the amount of money that's being bandied around for him, there's going to be pressure to put him in the team as much as possible, as early as possible, because you've just spent an absolute fortune on him. And I think he's only got sort of 30 or so Ukrainian Premier League games under his belt. Just over half of those for Shakhtar and a couple of loan moves as well in between. So Ferran Torres is a player. Another thing that we've seen from Edu and Mikel Arteta over the last couple of years, they've really, really liked signing players who have played in the Premier League before and are used to English football or know, you know, what the league's about or how the league's different to other leagues, maybe, and have shown that they can handle that and that they're good in the Premier League. And Ferran Torres is ticks that box as well. So yeah, that is an interesting one. It's one that probably makes quite a lot of sense. You know, if it's a deal that can get done, we know that Barcelona are in constant need of moving players on because of their financial troubles. Ferran Torres is a player who hasn't played that much this season. I think he played a fair bit at the back end of last season after he came in. This season, Ousmane Dembele's been fit. They signed Robert Lewandowski. They signed Rafinha. So there's just not as much time for him at the moment. You know, those two, especially, they signed for enormous money in contracts, but also transfer fees for Rafinha in the summer. So Ferran Torres is one of the players that's really missed out, I think, from those players coming in.
Mm.
It could be one to look out for. I mean, Barcelona, just generally speaking, are a team to constantly be looking at for players that we might want to pick up because they just are in absolute desperate need of getting money in all the time.
That's true, and I think their decision-making in recent years has been pretty suspect, you know?
That's polite.
Yeah, that is polite. I don't know that there's been a great deal of strategic thinking gone into their recruitment, you know, which is kind of the opposite to where Arsenal are. Just a quick one on Mudryk. You know, you referenced the fact that he doesn't have a lot of experience. 30-odd Ukrainian Premier League games, Champions League football. A player can emerge very quickly. We all know that. A player can shine and a player can be the right player for a club. But I've seen people express some reservations about the fee, you know, and what Shakhtar want. They know they've got a great asset, so they want to maximize that. We all understand it. But I don't think I've seen anybody saying, you know what, we should just, you know, when fans are desperate for a player, it's just like, pay what they want. Just give them what they want and get the player and stop this pussying around and just get the player, just pay them what they want. I haven't seen one person say that about Mudryk. I've seen people say, there's a limit to where we should go. Do you...
We've gone the other way as Arsenal fans, haven't we?
Kind
of. Like, it used to be a lot of that. And now it's like we signed Ben White and it's like, oh, that's a lot of money. Should we really be doing that with £50 million? And it's odd, but we have sort of gone from one end of the spectrum to the other.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what I was going to say to you. I mean, has what we've done in the last 18 months, like, if... Like, I think whatever we end up paying for Mudryk, if we bring him in, we're going to be overpaying a bit. I think there's no two ways about it. Based on his career to date, I think you would say whatever we pay is going to be overpaying a bit. And that's not the worst thing in the world. If it's the right player and the guy can do what you need him to do over the course of X amount of seasons, you know, we've made this point before and you just said it, like, nobody's talking about Ben White's fee anymore. Nobody says, oh, Ben White was 50 million. It's not like, it's not 50 million pound Ben White the same way it was 72 million pound Nicolas Pepe. Do you know what I mean? Because Ben White has sort of proved that the money we spent on him, you know, was good value, whereas Pepe never really did. But would you trust Arteta and Edu to know where the line is? Like, if it ends up being like 60 million, 65 million, which is, you know, close to a record transfer fee, would you trust their judgment when it came to that kind of an outlay?
I don't know. Is the honest answer. I don't know if I would trust them. It's hard when we've any of us have not really seen much of this player. It's not Ben White, who we've all had the chance to watch in the Premier League for a year, and then people say, yeah, he's good, or no, he's not good, and then they can actually sort of join in with that conversation a little bit. This is a very different situation. It's a player that almost nobody's seen very much of. And, you know, I think we don't have a choice but to trust them if that's the decision they make. I think any decision that's made to spend a lot of money this month is informed by our league position entirely.
Mm.
You know, I think if we had five fewer points, we wouldn't be overspending for anybody. It'd be like, right, we're in a good place. We'll probably get the Champions League. Or, like, we've put ourselves in a really good place to make sure we get Champions League. We're level with Man City with 24 games, 23 games left. Like, that's not going to happen to stay with them over 23 more games when you've got a 5-point cushion. It's a very different conversation. And it's like, okay, maybe this is a chance that we have to throw everything at. And I think, you know, you overpay in January anyway most of the time. I just think the fact that we're 5 points clear, I think if we're 5 points clear right now and they think that a signing gets us two or three extra points, suddenly you might be more willing to spend 10 or 15 million too much compared to if you thought we were level with City and the extra signing might get you, or we were a couple of points behind them and you thought the extra signing might get you two or three more points between now and the end of the season. I think it's the fact that it really, like, it's who knows how this season's going to go. But if we didn't sign anybody now and we lost somebody, you know, one of the wingers for 2 or 3 weeks, and we ended up dropping points and ending the season 4 points behind Manchester City.
Yeah.
They're going to sit there and kick themselves. And I think that's why I'm sure.
There'll be people lining up to kick them. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Everybody will go mental.
Yeah. So line around the block here, please. Take your turn.
It will be like that. So it's... I think it's just the fact that they've started so well and this opportunity now has presented itself to have a proper crack at something massive.
Yeah.
That they now can't, they can't really leave anything on the table. They just have to absolutely go for it. And I'm sure that will mean that we won't end this January like last January wondering, oh, are they going to bring some, oh, is it worth it? Like, nah, I think after that and the way the league table looks right now, they'll happily spend 10 or 15 million too much just to make sure they've thrown everything at it.
I mean, does the fact that we're after two players, seemingly after two players, does that tell you that they realise that this is, you know, this is an opportunity for Arsenal? You know, having worked so hard and done so well to get where we are in the table, that this is the kind of opportunity that you know, in the increasingly competitive landscape of the Premier League with plucky underdogs Newcastle looming much closer than people thought they would at this point. And, you know, they still have some phases to go through, right? We've seen what happens when think about Man City, you know, the kind of players that they started to bring in. And then over time, they became extremely good at attracting the best players. You know, that's something that we're going to have to face with Newcastle probably down the line. So do you think this is a kind of tacit admission that this year is a really, really, really big opportunity for Arsenal to fight all the way for the Premier League title?
Yeah, I think that must be in their thinking, but I don't think they're dismissing the future.
No. I don't mean to say that. I'm not trying to say that this is it. You know.
But I think they know. You know, this. We can talk about other teams dropping points and other teams making, you know, being able to spend more money and improve their sides and all that kind of thing. We need to also like just mention that it's the best start in the history of Arsenal Football Club. It's the best start ever to a season. We've never had this many points, this many wins after this many games. And we could be a much better team 2 or 3 years from now, and this hasn't happened again.
Mm.
So, you know, and you look at City, how many billions and how many more years ahead in their project compared to us. They're going for a third league title in a row. But you can still just turn up and have a bad day and drop points or get a couple of bad injuries and drop points. Just none of that's happened to us really so far this season. You know, bad refereeing decisions and suddenly the game go or a dodgy bounce. Like, it just hasn't happened to us so far this season. It will be incredible if at any time in the near future we play 15 games and we have this many points after 15 games again. So, I think all of that goes into the thinking that this, is an opportunity that might not come around again anytime soon. And not to say that we couldn't win the league anytime soon, but to be 5 points clear, almost at the halfway stage of the season, this is something, you know, that luxury that we might not have for a long, long time. So it does look now like a massive opportunity. And, you know, and just to go back to my point about the future, and I definitely didn't mean that you were
sure
dismissing the the future as well, but I think it says something when you sign, if we go to sign Mudryk for an enormous fee at the age of 22, like, it still fits the plan, it still fits the idea of building a young team and this young squad. it isn't kind of deviating as a last, well, not a last ditch attempt, but as a big roll of the dice. You're not spending loads of money on a 30-year-old. Like, it still fits the long term plan and the long term thinking at the club. It maybe just sort of accelerates things a little bit more.
All right. Well, let's see what happens with January. Let's talk a little bit about Brighton, because that is a game that we are playing on New Year's Eve. 5:30 kickoff in the evening. Brighton are seventh in the table. It kind of, I don't know if that's sort of passed people by, you know, because of what's happened with Graham Potter and the new guys come in and everything else. But, you know, we know from recent experience this is a tough team to play against. It's a tough place to go. They've got some really good players. They've got some guys who can genuinely hurt you. Trossard this season with 7 goals, which is more than any Arsenal player. So what are you expecting from Brighton on, what day is it? Saturday evening.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, I just can't fucking remember what day it is.
I'm expecting a really, really hard game. I think Brighton have been great this season. I thought they were really good under Graham Potter, and I think they've been good under De Zerbi as well, to be honest. I think they were a bit unlucky. I watched quite a few of their games when he came in, and I think it took sort of 4 games, 5 games until they got the first win. But I thought they were really unfortunate in that. You know, I don't think it will necessarily be a game that we... that we like really struggle in stylistically. Like, I think they'll play out from the back. They'll allow us chances to press and press high and squeeze them and try and steal the ball. They'll want to attract us, you know, and then try and play through us. It'll be a bit of a, I think more than a lot of games we play, and especially away from home, it'll be a bit of a wrestle for possession, really. So I think we'll be coming up against a really good side. At the same time, a side with the way they want to play football and have possession and get bodies forward, a side that will leave us spaces. You know, a really different challenge to West Ham last week, where once they were a goal up, well, it was all like everything was behind the ball. And then as soon as they were a goal up, like, there was no chance to press as well, because they would just get the ball and punt it as soon as they were in any sort of danger when we were closing them down high up pitch. So I think, you know, Brighton will be sort of the opposite, a very patient style of play, passing around at the back, looking to play through us and then hit those gaps that we leave if we're pressing high. It's an interesting one, but yeah, I don't fear them, I would say. I don't really fear anyone the way that we've played so far this season. But I think it'll be a really tricky game and a game where we have to earn possession as much as just having more of the ball.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that, you know, is the fact that Brighton don't have Caicedo. He's suspended for this game. And they don't have Alexis McAllister either. And they're the two guys with the most tackles. So that kind of bite in midfield that they provide, it's quite interesting to see us linked with a move for Caicedo, who I'm told we were looking at quite strongly in the summer, actually. So whether there's long-term interest there or not, I'm not sure. But Caicedo and McAllister being missing from their midfield is probably quite welcome from our perspective.
Yeah, I don't know if Billy Gilmore will play there. Billy Gilmore of Chelsea, or signed from Chelsea in the summer. I don't know if he'll play there. Pascal Gross, I think, will probably play centrally. He's played right back quite a lot under De Zerbi, and sort of plays as right back but gets forward and tucks in. So it will be interesting. I mean, especially when you say about the midfielders being out. I mean, Caicedo got booked, didn't he, against Southampton, and that was his fifth yellow card of the season. If you go to any team and two of their first choice midfielders are missing, it doesn't matter how they play. I think it's a massive issue for them. And, you know, once again, maybe things falling our way a little bit, and we've got to make the most of it, because we want to be 5 points clear for as long as possible.
Do you expect anything different from Mikel Arteta? I mean, the only thing I can think of is Zinchenko coming in for Tierney, and that's about as much as I think we'll do. If we do anything.
I think if Zinchenko can play for an hour, then we'll see that. The question is how fit. It's just always the question. How fit is Alexander Zinchenko?
Yeah.
I agree. Like, the rest of the team is kind of obvious and picks itself. Zinchenko and Tierney, I don't know. Is Zinchenko, was he getting minutes against West Ham because he's slowly working his way to fitness? Are they going to hold him back slightly for those huge games that you mentioned earlier? Newcastle, Tottenham, Man United all coming up in January. That's Mikel Arteta's decision, I guess, is how fit is he and how much do you want to get him ready or keep him ready for those matches?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see. We'll see on Saturday evening. So, before we finish, I was going to ask you, and I did ask you this, because it's the end of the year, and we're going into a brand new year. I know it's only mid-season, but just your top three Arsenal moments from 2022. I've got a few written down here as well, so maybe we'll do one at a time so you don't use them all up, because I suspect there might be a little bit of crossover.
There could be,
because there were certain parts of the year which, you know, I don't care to look back on too fondly, you know. So go on, give me your first Arsenal moment of 2022.
Well, and now I finally bring you back around to...
Oh, here it is.
Football curing illness. And I was bedridden with COVID when we played home against Wolves. And the only time we came from behind to win a game last season in the Premier League. And I was, for about 15 minutes, off pure adrenaline after we came back and turned that around and scored the injury time winner. Like, my headache was gone. I wasn't coughing. My nose was all cleared up. Like, everything, all of the symptoms that I'd had for the previous 3 or 4 days were all just gone.
Wow.
All thanks to the own goal that gave us a late win against Wolves at the Emirates. So, yeah, well, I mean, I think up to that point, even though we'd been really good last season, for large parts, there were still the sort of questions that by now I think have been answered a little bit. Mm. We saw it again the other day against West Ham. You know, but can we come from behind? We look good when we go ahead or when the game's even, but we weren't coming back and getting any results. Mikel Arteta's subs weren't really having much of an impact, and Nicola Pepe and Eddie Nketiah both came on that day and were really important in us turning it around to win. Yeah, it was just a really nice day, and especially because Arsenal scored a couple of late goals to relieve me of
your COVID
what had
symptoms.
Been the bane of my life for
right.
a few days.
Well, now we know how to make everyone feel better. Forget your Lemsip, forget your paracetamol. You just need bottled football adrenaline.
Late winners, Andrew.
Late winners.
Late winners.
The cure for everything. The cure for everything. That's
genuinely.
Sure. I'm going to go with my first one, and I think I'm going to choose beating Liverpool this season as a sort of marker of progress, because, you know, we've had some big wins. We've beaten Manchester United, but we've had this record against Liverpool where there's been like an inevitability about what was going to happen and how it was going to happen. Even with our best intentions, doing our most diligent work, we would get pulled apart time and time again by Liverpool. You know, stay in the game for a little bit and then they just fucking do you.
Isn't it in the Amazon Prime documentary and Ben White just really despondently is like, oh, they just get one chance and they fucking score it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter how well you stay in the game or how long you stay in the game, they'll get one chance and they just put us to bed.
Yeah, they'll do it. And look, we know that Mikel Arteta went to some great lengths to try and prepare his players for the threat of Liverpool. but I just think that was, you know, in this season, it sort of demonstrated something that we all hoped would be there and could be there about this team and about where it was going and where it could go and what it was capable of. And, you know, when you think back on it now, you know, we were ahead, then we were level, we were ahead, we were level, and then we went ahead again. You know, it wasn't a case that we just nicked a goal late on and beat them. It was that we responded every time. You know, and the goals that we conceded could easily have been really, well, they were disappointing goals because every goal you concede is disappointing. But, you know, if you're...
They never suck the air out
exactly,
of the situation.
Exactly. And I think That's my one. That's my number number one. My first choice, anyway, moments of 2022. So, give us a second one.
Take your pick. Winning at Stamford Bridge, it's great every single time. We do it. We keep doing it every year now, and it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you were going to pick that or pick one of them.
I wasn't.
Then I'll just talk about both of them.
Which did you enjoy most? The kind of the 4-2 where we sort of had that late penalty. Was it Bukayo Saka with a late penalty as well?
Yeah, and Ketia scored twice.
Yeah, like, and everyone was going like, "What fuck, Eddie? Jesus!"
And we just lost to Brighton, and
it was part of that three in a row, wasn't it? Was it the three?
Yeah, lost to Brighton and Southampton and
Crystal
and
Palace.
The other one was
it Palace?
I think it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah, because we'd lost the day that we lost Thomas Partey to injury, and we learned that Kieran Tierney was injured.
Mm.
And then everyone was like, "Well, that's it. Then we're not finishing in the top four."
I mean, they were right ultimately.
They were right, everyone wrote it off at that moment. And then we went and beat Chelsea, and then we went and beat Man United, and then we won at West Ham as well. It was really nice. 10 days or so, but the win at Chelsea, I think, after three defeats in a row, and then we rocked up to Stamford Bridge and beat them, that was great. And you know, I think both of them, but especially that one, there were videos from the Chelsea end of Aaron Ramsdale taunting them after our goals and celebrating the penalty and all that sort of thing, which is always lovely.
Sure.
And this season's one I'd loved, because I thought we just dominated completely. Like, I can't remember the last time. You know, people talk about that win at Man City all those years ago now in 2014-15 as like, Arsenal have gone away and played really well at a big game away from home. But not like we didn't dominate the game. This was the first time in a really long time that I can think of Arsenal going away from home against one of the top sides and actually just dominating for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, the goal was a little bit scrappy maybe from the corner. But it's also just the momentum of this season and that whole title race thing that we're like the Chelsea game for me was the first time I remember everyone sort of going like, I guess we have to talk about it then and not, when do we talk about if we're in a title race or not? It was like, no, we've won at Stamford Bridge and massively deserved it. So now we cannot avoid that conversation. Let's talk about how we're going to win the league, which, you know, I think it was just, I think we'll be a better football team in 12 months and in 24 months than we are now. I don't know if we'll be in a title race or if we'll stay in this one. But I think in a year and in 2 years and in 3 years, when hopefully we're in the Champions League and going on long runs and really competing for things, I think we'll look back at that game at Chelsea and say like, yeah, we all kind of realized that day this is a really serious team.
All right, I can't argue with that. My second one, like, it's a two-parter. One is this sort of the emergence of the William Saliba chant.
I was gonna go for that, yeah,
in that game away from, was it against Brentford?
Bournemouth,
that's what it was. It was against Bournemouth. And just the way that sort of sprang to life and became a thing and everything else. But the other part of it is the Saliba own goal against Leicester and the reaction of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And in previous seasons, I don't think it's unfair to say that there might have been a different reaction if we'd scored an own goal. And I know some of it has to do with the player himself, because there's a lot of goodwill on his part. But also, I just think it speaks to the way that the crowd is at the Emirates now and the way the fans are so behind the team. And that was the perfect manifestation of that support, you know, where game's going well, then something goes wrong. And rather than people going crazy and going like getting angry about it, there was this sort of outpouring of support for the team. And I think, did we score within 2 minutes, something like that, whatever it was? You know, so I know there's a sort of cause and correlation kind of thing here. You're sort of drawing a line between one thing and another thing, which isn't maybe necessarily there, But I just think as a moment to tell you about how things have changed at Arsenal over the last 2 or 3 years, that was the perfect encapsulation of that for me anyway.
Yeah, I was gonna mention the Saliba chant, and not just the fact that that chant emerged at Bournemouth that day, but then he capped it off with probably the best goal he'll ever score.
Yes,
finding the top corner with his weak foot on the day that everybody decided to sing his name for an hour.
Yeah, non-stop.
Yeah, that's great. And I think the next home game, I can't remember what it was, but the next few home games after that, I'm pretty sure that was played at full time at the Emirates as well. I think the next game was maybe Fulham. At home, and then that was played on 90 minutes after we'd come from behind to beat Fulham, so the entire stadium was singing it. So that chant's been great. Another chant, and sort of in a similar vein, I guess for me then is the Mikel Arteta chant, because we have been a long, long way for a long, long time from a stadium or an entire away end seeing the manager's name.
Sure.
And I, for me, that, yeah, probably encapsulates the same sort of thinking that, you know, it was Villa away when that really took off last season. But we've heard it every single game since. And that's win, lose or draw. We've heard it at games when we've lost or when we're losing. And I think that it's this last 12 months, there's just been a sort of a wave of enthusiasm for the team and for the club and unity, really, amongst the fan base. Obviously, winning every week helps, but this was last season and we weren't winning every week. We were fighting for fourth when this sort of started. We were all believing in something again. None of us expected this. Mikel Arteta says himself, and we all agree, we all think so, that this is ahead of plan where we thought we might be or hoped we would be even. But, you know, just that culmination of everything and the fact that win, lose or draw, the manager's name is being sung every single game by most fans, I'm sure. There are still fans. There's always people that don't see eye to eye on something, but yeah, that's I didn't think that would happen, not after the way the previous season had gone and last season had started. I thought it would take longer, after the wounds of Arsene Wenger and Unai Emery even, and yeah, it just feels like there's been so many rifts for such a long time, and Mikel Arteta has somehow managed to sort of put everything back together.
Well, that was going to be my final one, which is sort of not necessarily a moment, but a sort of change in people's perception of Mikel Arteta, and that comes after the Amazon documentary, which is, you know fine well that I had some reservations about our involvement in that, right? But I think the fact that not just Arsenal fans, you know, people that I spoke to, friends who support other clubs and, you know, people who write about football and talk about football and all kinds of things have looked at that documentary and sort of realized that this is a young, energetic, slightly eccentric, idiosyncratic guy who's doing his best, who is, you know, pretty much, you know, what you see is what you get in many ways, because he's pretty clear. You know, he's pretty clear about what he expects. Like, I don't think Arteta's the kind of guy who, you know, has a lot of hidden agendas. Like, if you do what he wants you to do, you're going to stay on the right side of Mikel Arteta, you know, whether you play every week or not or whatever. But, you know, I think people's opinions about him changed quite a lot after that documentary for the better. And I do feel like after everything that he has gone through as a manager, you know, we've talked about it, you know, the club that he came into, the COVID thing, the impact of COVID, the various issues.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Issues that he's had with certain players, big name players, decisions that he's had to make, which have been difficult and unpopular decisions, all of that kind of stuff. I just think that, you know, from, I think that the documentary's given him not a lease of life, that's the wrong word, but it has change the way people think about him and what he's capable of and what he's doing at Arsenal and what he's doing at Arsenal. First and foremost, you can see it by where we are in the league. You know, we're top of the table and everything else. But I think it has gone a long way to instill belief in Arsenal fans, maybe not as much, but just sort of, it's sort of copper fastened his position as one of the best young managers in the game.
Yeah, it reminds me, just you talking there reminds me of actually an old Unai Emery interview when he was, I think, towards the end of his time at PSG, and he spoke about every club needing to recognise who's in charge of the club, and that at Real Madrid it's Florentino Perez, and at Barcelona it was Lionel Messi. And at the time, yeah. and at PSG, when he got there, he realized, like, right, okay, like, I have to accept that it's Neymar. And that's just the situation that I'm in. I don't think, or I think for a few years, our biggest problem maybe was that we didn't know who was in charge of the club. It was very unclear who was running Arsenal, who was the face of the club, who was the voice of the club, who, when it came to it and a hard decision had to be made, who would make that decision? And I think we know now. I don't think any decision is made unless it's the decision that Mikel Arteta wants. And I think he's earned that position as well. Sure. So it's, yeah, it's nice to have him in charge. And it's just nice to have someone in charge who's doing a good job and you can trust the direction that they're pulling everything in. And it really does feel like everybody's behind him.
Mm. The direction and possibly even the process. Who knows? Who are we to say? Just final one for me. I have to say, you know, on a personal level, the podcast, the live show we did with the Arsenal Vision lads at Union Chapel at the end of last season, despite the fact that it had ended at that point, there was the possibility of a miracle, but nobody really expected it to happen. But the fact that we were able to have such a great night and bring so many people together and Arsenal fans together in such numbers was absolutely amazing. And, you know, fingers crossed we can do that again at the end of this season. Whether we have a title or a trophy to celebrate, we'll have to wait and see. So, look, we better leave it there. Lewis, Happy New Year to you and yours. We'll talk to you next year. Thanks as always.
Happy New Year to you as well and to everybody else. And thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to Lewis. You can find him on Twitter. He is at LG Ambrose, at LG Ambrose. And Lewis and I preview every Premier League game over on Patreon, normal weeks, of course. You can sign up if you'd like to support everything that we do on Arsblog, as well as getting extra bonus content at patreon.com/Arsblog. That's patreon.com/Arsblog. So look, next time we talk, it's going to be, well, it's going to be next year. It's going to be 2023. Sounds ridiculous when you say it out loud, doesn't it? 2023. Fuck. So I would just like to say that being with you throughout 2022 has been a pleasure as always. I want to thank you all so much for listening and for subscribing and for downloading and all the rest. I wish you and yours a very, very happy and healthy and peaceful 2023, wherever you are in the world, particularly if in your part of the world that is something which is much more acute, which is part of your day-to-day reality. I wish you and everybody well, and all we can do throughout 2023 is do our best as people, as human beings, to look after each other. If you're in a position to lend a hand, to do some good, to help, then that's what we need to do. More and more that feels like a responsibility that can't be shirked. If you're in a position to do something about the many things that are wrong and unjust about this world, whatever it might be, every small bit helps. Every small bit counts. Think of others, and let's see if we can make 2023 a better place for as many people as we can. So with that in mind, let's also hope that Arsenal beat the ever-loving fuck out of every team that we face in 2023. I think you can care about the well-being and happiness of other people, but still want fans of every other football club to have a terrible time. I think that's all right. James and I will be here on New Year's Day. I think we're going to have a podcast, an Arscast Extra for you. So you might be lying on the couch. You might have a sore head after the night before, and hopefully you've got a sore head from celebrating Arsenal's win over Brighton. Let's keep fingers crossed for that. Have a very happy new year. Peace and love to you and yours, and we'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. I'm Liam Neeson, and I'm here to wish you a very happy new 2023. Now, you might be asking yourself, what has Liam Neeson got to do with a football podcast? And the answer, of course, is absolutely nothing. However, for those of you thinking about listening to something else in the new year, know this. I have a very particular set of skills. I will find you, and I'll make you a delicious sandwich. Because if that doesn't convince you to keep listening, then what will? Happy New 23 from me, not Liam Neeson.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.